Last month, the Guggenheim Museum celebrated its 50th anniversary, and to mark the occasion, it mounted a full-scale retrospective of the work of Vasily Kandinsky. The exhibit includes some 100 paintings and more than 60 works on paper, organized from the museum's vast collection and augmented by other collections. Back in September, I spoke to Tracy Bashkoff, curator of collections and exhibitions at the museum, and Carol Vail, assistant curator of the show, about the Kandinsky retrospective. And since it's still on display at the Guggenheim, we thought that we would rebroadcast that conversation today. I began by asking Tracy Bashkoff, why is the Guggenheim presenting this Kandinsky exhibition as a way of celebrating its anniversary? Is it because his work was so central to the Guggenheim's collection, at least at the beginning?
Absolutely. Kandinsky is pretty much the patron saint artist of the Guggenheim Museum. He's the artist that's most associated with our collection, and that's because of Solomon Guggenheim's focus in his collection from the early days on. In about 1928, Hille von Riebe, a young artist from Germany, arrived in New York and was hired to paint Solomon's portrait. And in the course of their conversations during this portrait sessions, she spoke about the vanguard artists that she had encountered in Berlin at the Der Sturm Gallery, and got Solomon Guggenheim very excited about this really innovative type of art, non-objective painting, a form of abstraction that really removes itself from observations of the everyday world, and got him to focus his collecting habits on those works.
And Carol, the Guggenheim was originally called the Museum of Non-Objective History. You edited a book about the history of the museum?
Yes, that's right. I just published, I'm the editor and one of the co-authors of The Museum of Non-Objective Painting, Hille Riebe and the Origins of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum. It really focuses on the early history of the museum when it opened in 1939.
And a distinction was made between calling it non-objective and abstract painting?
Absolutely. There's always been a lot of discussion between the subtleties of non-objective painting and abstraction. Non-objective really is a form of abstraction with absolutely no ties to the observable world, the empirical world, and which also aspires to spiritual and utopian goals, whereas abstraction is really abstracted from an object, from a visible object in this world.
It's been claimed, Tracy, that Kandinsky painted the first completely non-objective painting, although there have been cases made for Frantisek Kupka, Robert Delaunay, the American Arthur C. Dove, and some others. Do you think Kandinsky was the first?
Well, I think he was a pioneer of abstraction, and you could add Mondrian and Malevich and other artists to that list. And certainly as a theoretician as well, he gave us really our first language and vocabulary about abstraction.
It's been said, Carol, that Hille Riebe had Kandinsky's work in mind when she commissioned Frank Lloyd Wright to design the building.
Absolutely. She had Kandinsky in mind. She also had Rudolf Bauer in mind, who was another painter that she was very close to, who in fact advised her and Guggenheim on buying works for the collection, and among them, of course, Kandinsky. But Kandinsky really was the central focus of Guggenheim's collection habits.
Well, this exhibit has been put together mainly from the collections of three museums. They have the largest holdings?
We do. The Guggenheim, along with the Centre Pompidou and the Lenbach House in Munich, all have the largest holdings of Kandinsky worldwide, and for very different reasons. Ours, our connection, as I mentioned, with Solomon Guggenheim and directly with Kandinsky through Hille Riebe as well, and the Centre Pompidou through Nina Kandinsky, the widow of Kandinsky, who was a friend of Madame Pompidou's and ultimately left a large part of her collection in their holdings, and at the Lenbach House in Munich through the artist Gabriel Munter, who was involved in a long relationship with Kandinsky. And
she was there during most of the important years.
Exactly, during that really that path to abstraction up until about 1914. They split in about 1916. And her holdings and as of her own work as well as of Kandinsky's went to the Lenbach House in Munich.
And then you got works from other museums and private collections.
Yes, we have some wonderful and generous loans, private collections, and as well as public institutions, works from Russia, two loans from the Georgian National Museum in Tbilisi that have never traveled to the U.S.
If one of those, the 1911 picture with a circle, is said to have been his first completely non-objective painting.
Yes, It's a work that was, its whereabouts were unknown for some time, particularly when the catalogue raisonné on Kandinsky was written in the 1980s. And it surfaced after Perestroika, and there's a note on the back written in the hand of one of Kandinsky's studio assistants that mentions that the piece is the first truly non-objective work. And of course, this brings all sorts of new issues up for art historians. In fact, one of the works from 1913 in our collection, Painting with Black Lines, is had been mentioned by Kandinsky as being among his first truly non-objective works. And so it's an interesting and ongoing debate.
Well, he's obviously, Carol, having some kind of dialogue with things that are that he finds in nature, and then just things that are, can be called non-objective, because he's going through a period where he's thinking about the nature of art.
No, absolutely. In fact, he's always moving from figuration to abstraction, and he never wants to frighten his viewer with going totally abstract. Kandinsky didn't become a painter until he was, in fact, rather late, relatively speaking, when he was 30 years old. And so maybe he had some kind of trepidations in regard to his audience. And even though he claims, or there is this claim, that the first non-objective painting was 1911, even after 1911, you still see traces of recognizable subjects and motifs. And he's always going back to favorite motifs and themes, such as the Blue Rider, the apocalypse, and other such things.
Well, he started when he was almost 30. I can't think of another great artist who started that late. Matisse is quite remarkable for starting in his early 20s.
Right.
He originally studied law and economics. What spurred him to leave Russia and study painting in Munich?
Well, there are two moments that he speaks about, and one is going to see a Wagner concert and being so moved about how music can communicate so immediately and emotionally with people, and wanting to strive to get that sort of reaction in painting, as well as seeing a Monet Haystack painting in an exhibition of Impressionism, and understanding that it wasn't so much the subject matter of the work, it wasn't about haystacks, but it was about color and form, and that could communicate in a very immediate way.
Well, the first painting in the show he made when he was 40, so it took him 10 years to get to the point where he did something that anybody would want to put in a museum?
Well, when he first got to Munich, he was studying in academic settings and wasn't very happy with those settings. And before long, he was setting himself up as a teacher and founding small art groups. And his paintings from those early years are really travel logs, oil sketches that he did on his travels to record things. And the work that we focused on as the pivotal beginning point of the exhibition is really his dealing with bigger subject matters.
And it seems to be a collection of masterpieces, one great painting after another. It was extraordinary how many good paintings he turned out, actually. And I'm sure there were a few that you wish you could have gotten a hold of that didn't wind up in the show.
Of course, there's always something that gets away. But for example, in this case, a lovely work from the Art Institute of Chicago joined the exhibition in Munich when it first opened a year ago, but then had to return to Chicago for the opening of their beautiful new wing of the museum. And we completely understand and miss it here, but know that it's being well looked at there.
My guests are Tracy Bashkov, curator of collections and exhibitions at the Guggenheim Museum, and Carol Vail, assistant curator, one of the people responsible for this major retrospective, also the author of a book about the history of the museum. And there is also a fabulous catalog from this exhibition. We touched on the music connection. Now, for Kandinsky, music was really important, wasn't it, Carol? Music and spirituality, and he came up with a theory of art based on that?
Yes, music was very important. In fact, he was quite an accomplished musician himself. He played the cello. He always aspired to the abstract condition of music.
And because music can stir up emotions without having any real connection to the real world.
Absolutely. And that's really what he found so exceptional about music. And so when he heard this Wagner opera, he was stirred to paint. And then another incident happened in 1911 when he went to a concert in Munich of Arnold Schoenberg, and he was so stirred that he began immediately after that concert. He made a painting called, in fact, Impression Concert, and he began a long correspondence with Schoenberg, as both men, in fact, were aspiring to the same kind of philosophical condition.
And Schoenberg also was a painter.
And Schoenberg, of course, was a painter. He was, of course, not as radical as Kandinsky, but he did participate in some of the very early exhibitions that Kandinsky was organizing in Munich. So they certainly had many affinities.
And so Kandinsky paints series of works with titles like Composition, Impression, Improvisation, the kinds of things that could be attached to musical pieces.
Absolutely. These are three very important categories in his throughout his work. The compositions are probably the works which are the most thought out, the most complex, and he painted only 10 of those. The improvisations are works are really of an inner character, and then there are also the impressions, which are those which are maybe most closely have something to do with the external world.
Now, he got caught up in the politics of the time. He lived in Germany and established himself and was always seemed to be want to be a part of a group. He doesn't strike me as the kind of lone painter who likes to stay in the studio all the time.
Yes, particularly in the early parts of his career, he was associated with very very active groups, particularly in Munich, and the Blau Rider group was one of the founders along with Franz Marc. Though at the end of his life, in the Paris years, he did kind of keep to himself.
Although after he was forced to leave Germany when the war broke out, he went back to Russia rather than Paris or Amsterdam.
Right. He maintained his Russian passport, and he went back to Russia, to Moscow. And there his family had some property. He had some land, which was repatriated in 1917. But for some time he was able to live with that property.
And then was he forced out because of the changes in political currents in the Soviet Union? At a certain point, first there had been this incredible flourishing of abstract art and non-objective art, and then people like Stalin started saying, hey, this is too intellectual and people can't understand it, and artists were being sent to jail.
Yeah, he left just on the verge of that. He was in Moscow until 1921, and he was sitting on the various administrative and councils that were setting up art schools and reorganizing museums in Russia. He was working alongside of the constructivists and the suprematists, and his work was always a bit at odds with what they were doing in abstraction. They were looking for a pure geometry. His abstraction had content in a different way, and ultimately found that it wasn't the best atmosphere for him and left in 1921.
And then wound up at the Bauhaus.
Right, where he found a much more open and congenial atmosphere to paint in.
Friends with Paul Klee?
Yes, they shared a master house. Once the Bauhaus moved to Dessau, Walter Gropius had built these wonderful buildings for the teachers to share, and he and Klee shared one.
And then he went to Paris when the Nazis came to power.
Exactly. The Bauhaus by now had moved to Berlin in 1933 due to Nazi pressure. The Bauhaus closed, and so Kandinsky and his wife were forced yet again to go into exile.
Well, some Bauhaus people came to the United States. In fact, most of the Gropius went to Chicago.
No, absolutely. That is true. And Kandinsky never came to the U.S., and there were a lot of people who wanted to come over, namely Solomon Guggenheim and Hilary Riebe, who'd urge him to come over here, and he'd also had other invitations to come over. He'd always had a great presence in the U.S. since 1912, which is when his work was first exhibited. But he never came here. He decided he wanted to go back to Paris, which he'd known already as a young man.
Now, we know that he had a real influence on other artists, actually, probably inspired a lot of people to think about making non-objective paintings. What about the other way? Were there artists he was meeting in Germany and in France who he was influenced by?
Sure. In the last years, in the Paris years, where he was working between 1934 and 1944 when he died, he was in close contact with Juan Miró and with Jean Arp, and you see the influence of their works, their attention to biomorphic forms and organic shapes are prevalent in his canvases of that time.
Is this the most comprehensive show of his best works that has ever been put together?
Oh, it's the most comprehensive for some time. In the 1980s, the Guggenheim did a trio of exhibitions that were extremely important to the scholarship of Kandinsky, but did combine his work with other artists and really showed all aspects of his career. This is a look at his paintings in a very extensive way.
And we have a slideshow of some of the paintings from the exhibit on our website at WMYC.org. There's also a show of photographs from his days in Munich and other parts of Europe being shown in conjunction with the show in the basement?
Yes, that's right. In our Sackler Center, in our Center for Education, we have a travelogue of photographs taken by Gabriele Münter, his companion, between 1908 and 1916. Photographs that she took and that he also took. And these really document the years that they lived together, worked and traveled together throughout Germany, Amsterdam, France, Italy, and especially Munich and Murnau, where they were living just outside of Munich in a little alpine village, which was very inspirational to Kandinsky.
It's odd to me that he kept on going to places where his work was going to cause trouble. First the Soviet Union found his work unacceptable, and then he was included in the degenerate artists of the Nazis. Were his works destroyed as a result?
There were a number of works that were destroyed. In fact, this exhibition, while it focuses on the ultimate end result canvases, we do have one or two sketches or studies, like the sketch for Composition 2, which was the ultimate work, which was two times the size of the sketch, was destroyed during World War II.
The Kandinsky of Vasily Kandinsky retrospective is at the Guggenheim Museum, and it's running there until January 13th. My great thanks to two of the people responsible for putting together this wonderful show and the books connected with it, Tracy Bashkov, curator of collections and exhibitions at the museum, and Carol Vale, assistant curator, and the editor and one of the contributors to a book about the history of the museum.
Correct.
I thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.